Translation purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. O unborn one, please enlighten us regarding the ways and means by which we can offer you all enjoyable grains and commodities, so that both we and all other living entities in this world can maintain ourselves without disturbance and can easily accumulate the necessities of life both for you and for ourselves. Developed consciousness begins from the human form of life and further increases in the forms of the demigods living in higher planets. The earth is situated almost in the middle of the universe, and the human form of life is the intermediate stage between the life of the demigods and that of the demons. The planetary systems above the earth are especially meant for the higher intellectuals called demigods. They are called demigods because although their standard of life is far more advanced in culture, enjoyment, luxury, beauty, education, and duration of life, they are always fully God-conscious. Such demigods are always ready to render service to the Supreme Lord because they are perfectly aware of the fact that every living entity is constitutionally an eternal subordinate servitor of the Lord. They also know that it is the Lord only who can maintain all living entities with all the necessities of life. The Vedic hymns, Eko bahunam yo vidhati kamam, ta enam abhruvanam ayatnam na prajanahi yasmin patishthita annam adame, etc. confirm this truth. In Bhagavad Gita also, the Lord is mentioned as Bhutabhrut, or the maintainer of all living creatures. The modern theory that starvation is due to an increase in population is not accepted by the demigods or the devotees of the Lord. The devotees or demigods are fully aware that the Lord can maintain any number of living entities, provided they are conscious of how they eat. If they want to eat like ordinary animals who have no God consciousness, then they must live in starvation, poverty and want, like the jungle animals in the forest. The jungle animals are also maintained by the Lord with their respective foodstuffs, but they are not advanced in God consciousness. Similarly, human beings are provided food, grains, vegetables, fruits, and milk by the grace of the Lord, but it is the duty of human beings to acknowledge the mercy of the Lord. As a matter of gratitude, they should feel obliged to the Lord for their supply of foodstuff, and they must first offer him food in sacrifice and then partake of the elements, of the remnants. In Bhagavad Gita 3.13, it is confirmed that one who takes foodstuffs after a performance of sacrifice eats real food for proper maintenance of the body and soul. But one who cooks for himself and does not perform any sacrifice eats only lumps of sin in the shape of foodstuffs. Such sinful eating can never make one happy or free from scarcity. Famine is not due to an increase in population, as less intelligent economists think. When human society is grateful to the Lord for all his gifts and the maintenance of the living entities, then there is certainly no scarcity or want in society. But when men are unaware of the intrinsic value of such gifts from the Lord, surely they are in want. A person who has no God consciousness may live in opulence for the time being due to his past virtuous acts. But if one forgets his relationship with the Lord, certainly he must await the stage of starvation by the law of the powerful material nature. One cannot escape the vigilance of the powerful material nature unless he leads a God-conscious or devotional life. Om Ajnanati Mirandhasya Jnananjani Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Aishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. My dear Lord, please grant us the vision by which we can understand how you are maintaining and guiding us in all aspects of our life, material and spiritual. Hare Krishna. So in this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the devatas are describing how the material world functions. And I will talk in this session in three broad parts. I'll talk about the scriptural context, then I'll talk about the modern context, and then I'll talk about the linking the two. So broadly speaking, here Srila Prabhupada in the purport is making several interesting points. There are places where the devatas are referred to as, so we'll talk about the scriptural context, what is going on in this particular section. Then Prabhupada talks about the contemporary context in the purport. So we'll talk about that. And then linking the contexts. How much is that possible and how is it possible? So what is the scriptural context that is going on over here? Here Prabhupada is talking about the devatas praying to the Lord. And he is giving us a vision of the universe where the earth is in the middle and above is broadly the domain of the devatas. And these devatas are praying to the all-pervading Supreme Lord. And to the extent they are praying to him, Prabhupada is talking about devatas in two remarkable terms over here. He's saying they're intellectuals. So now the devatas are generally, especially depending on whom we refer to. If you consider Indra, he's a quintessential Kshatriya. Indra is a warrior. Brahma is more like a Brahmana. Prabhupada is using the word intellectuals in the sense of one who is intellectually aware of the bigger picture. And then Prabhupada is also referring to them, equating them with devotees, even pure devotees. Not all the devatas are pure devotees. And many of the narratives in scripture are about how the devatas are exposed in that way. But it depends on what they are doing at what time. So here, they are offering prayers to the Lord with full awareness. And in that context, Prabhupada is appreciating. And then he is framing the discussion from that perspective. So the devatas are themselves considered to be administrators of the universe. And they are telling us how the universe actually works. So while the devatas are praying, they're saying that you please guide us how we can satisfy you. By which you can satisfy us. By which you can provide for our needs. So when the devatas are praying over here and they are using the word we. See, the word we, because it is such an inclusive term, it also makes it a very malleable term. So for example, if we are praying to the deities, say, then when somebody uses the word we, they may be referring to themselves as a whole community, referring to, and we are the community, we are offering prayers on behalf of the community to the deities. But on the other hand, if some members of the community come to the management and they say, we have these concerns. So there, we doesn't refer to the whole community. We refers to the members of the community as separated from the leaders of the community, the managers of the community. So the word we can mean many different things. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna uses the same frame of reciprocation. And he says, we need to perform sacrifice to satisfy the devatas. Devan bhavyata nena te deva bhavayantu vaha parasparam bhavayantaha shreyah paramavapsyatha. So he says, we satisfy the devatas and the devatas satisfy us. So now, of course, among the devatas, they're the Supreme Lord. And Krishna, in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is focusing on Karma Yoga. Therefore, he does not emphasize his position over there so much. So in one sense, we could say that if we are on the earth, then we understand that there is something up there. Now, what that is, we don't know. That something up there, we don't know means we may not know. Something up there, something bigger than us, is actually maintaining us. And we need to harmonize with that. So, that is, if we consider ourselves to be humans. But, if we consider here, we are humans over here on earth, and the devatas are over here, and we are all a part of the universe. And then here we are harmonizing with the Lord. So the word we can refer to both. We as earthly beings harmonizing with some higher reality. And we can also refer to the devatas along with all other living beings. So that's why Ubhayesham it is said. That not only we, but all living beings, the verse says, we, please guide us how we can satisfy you. And then you will provide for us. So the idea essentially is that the devatas are articulating what is true for them and is also true for us. That we depend on something beyond us for our sustenance. And this understanding was implicit in the Vedic tradition. And not just in the Vedic tradition, across the world, the idea that our human existence is so fragile and vulnerable that we are at the mercy of some powers bigger than ourselves, that was almost everywhere across history and geography before the pre-modern times or before the modern times, in the pre-modern times, specifically in the pre-scientific age, that we need, if we live in a, say, a farming setting where the primary source of sustenance is through agriculture, now we depend on rains. Now we may choose to believe that the rains come at random, or we may choose to believe that the rains are governed by some beings. But it is very clear that we depend on rains. So the idea is that there is some unknown bigger than us which shapes our lives, which in fact determines whether we live or die. So the closer we are to nature, the more obvious it is. Now it is not that it is not obvious today, but the understanding has changed. So basically, there is, I am here, and there is some large unknown that shapes my life. Now that unknown we can perceive could be three ways. Could be for us, could be against us, or could be indifferent to us. That unknown which sustains my existence, that cares for, that likes me, that loves me, that hates me, or that doesn't even bother whether I exist or not. There's only three possibilities how we could view that unknown. Now, while it can seem that this unknown which exists somewhere high up doesn't care for us, say when famines occur, when disasters occur, but the nature of life, if we reflect carefully on it, is that our very existence is a miracle. If we consider how many people are able to survive, that if we go to a mansion and we find there are 50 rooms in that mansion and one room is totally disorderly. The other 49 rooms are clean and very neat and tidy. Now we could look at the evidence of the 49 rooms and say there's some caretaker for this room. Or we could look at the evidence of that one room which is disorderly and say there's no caretaker over here. So it depends. Similarly, in this world, the fact that rains occur, the fact that grains grow from the earth, the fact that what we need is provided for, points to not just an organizing principle, but a benevolent organizing principle. Now, it's also a fact that there are times when these things are not provided for. In fact, these things are taken away from us. So ultimately, faith, it's a matter of the choice of evidence. If a person wants to not believe in God, then they can find abundant evidence for their disbelief in God. If a person wants to believe in God, they can find more than abundant evidence for belief in God. But it is a matter of which evidence a person will focus on. So that's why the saying is that believers need no reasons, non-believers accept no reasons. So that's it's not a matter of the verdict of the universe. In the Prabhupada quotes the verse, one part of the verse here, Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam Eko Bahunam Yovidhati Kaman. That one being sustains all beings. Now, that sustenance, if you look at the Upanishadic context, is not just physically. It is also intellectually. That means, if somebody wants to disbelieve God, somebody wants to deny God's existence, God will sustain their disbelief also. So even the power to reject God comes from God. Krishna says, Mattaha smritir jnanam apohanam cha. I give knowledge, remembrance and forgetfulness. So for someone who wants to focus on the evidence that God doesn't exist, that there is no organizing principle, that is what Krishna will focus on. So it's interesting, 15.15, this is the verse that Krishna gives these three things, knowledge, remembrance and forgetfulness. So what is this referring to? See, this comes, 15.15 comes after 15.12-14. That 12-14 is actually Krishna showing how he's the sustainer of the world. He talks about, in the 12th verse, he talks about at the cosmic level, at the cosmological level, yadadittigatam tejo jagat bhasete akhilam yachandramasi yachagnam tat tejo vidhimamakam. He says, the earth could not, life could not exist without the sun giving energy. And Krishna says, it is I who arrange for the sun to give energy. Then he talks at the terrestrial level. The earth is floating in space. And gama vishchache bhutani dharayami hamojasa pushnami chaushadi sarva somo bhutvarasatmakaha. He says, it is I who enter into the earth. And it is by my energy I sustain it. And then he talks at the ecological and the physiological levels. He says, Aham Vaishwanaro Bhutva Praninam Dehamashrita Prana Panasama Yukta Pachamyanam Chaturvidham. So he's talking about, actually, the terrestrial and the ecological both come in the 13th verse. So at the ecological level, he says, it is he who arranges for vegetables to grow by which we can be sustained. And then it is said, he who digests our food. Actually speaking, even when we get food, how that food converts into energy is itself a physiological miracle. Doctors try to replicate organs when they get damaged. Suppose somebody's hand is damaged, you can get a prosthetic hand. Somebody's eyes are damaged, we can get glasses. Somebody's heart is damaged, you can get a pacemaker. Somebody's digestive system is damaged, scientists are trying to make an artificial digestive machine. Even with the best technology, they find it will not be a machine, it will be a factory. And even with no matter how much crunching of chips you do, it's such a complicated process. Nobody has been able to make an artificial digestive machine till now. There are attempts to make, but the point is, even if they succeed, there is a lot of complexity over there. So, what requires the sustained intelligence of among the most intelligent and dedicated people in that field? How does it come out naturally? There is some governing principle, there's some organizing principle. So Krishna says, he gives this vision. This is what he calls actually as Jnana Chakshu. Jnana Chakshu can mean many different things. The eyes of knowledge. So we may not be able to see the spiritual right now, but we can see the hand of the divine even in the material. So the understanding that the material mechanisms that sustain us have some higher organizing principle was implicit in the tradition. Now, I was saying that the 1515 comes at the end of this. So Arjuna has this question, if you are maintaining everyone, why is it that everyone is not able to see you as the maintainer? Krishna says, I maintain not just people's body, but also their mind and their mental conceptions. So if somebody wants to be an atheist, I will give them the knowledge of the evidence. Oh, in this 50 room, there is one room which is disorderly. Just see, there that famine happened, there this happened, there that happened. And not only that, I will give them the remembrance of all that. First I'll give them the knowledge. See, we learn so many things, but we remember few of them. We may have had many interactions with a person, but when somebody asks us, what do you think about this person? You know, it's not that we at that moment with our brain do a comprehensive recall of all the incidents that we have had that with that person and then we give some assessment. There are some memories of our interaction with that person that stand out. And based on that remembrance, we give an assessment. So we, from what we learn, in the Bhagavad Gita, knowledge is often equated with perception, the taking in of information. From all that we take in, there is some that we remember and much that we forget. And what determines that is our desire. So the devatas are saying, please give us remembrance by which we can appreciate what you are doing for us and we can reciprocate appropriately. So this is the broad traditional scriptural context. Now, if we move to the contemporary context. So, in the contemporary context, as technology, as science started progressing, and especially technology started progressing, certain foundational changes in the worldview started occurring. So, Francis Bacon was the pioneer of the scientific method. So he had the saying that knowledge is power. Now it's quoted very often as a universal dictum that knowledge is power. And we sometimes devotees also quoted for saying that spiritual knowledge will give us inner power, which is true. But Francis Bacon used it in a particular sense. His idea was that nature is evil. Nature subjects us to so many sufferings. So rather than conceiving of nature as a mother, he conceived of nature as a stepmother. And he said technological knowledge will give us the power to subordinate this evil stepmother to our will. So nature is evil. Technology is the power that will help us to tame nature and bend it to our will. So now technology can be used for many different purposes, but basically what happened is that I said the universe can be seen in three different ways. That unknown, it's benevolent, it is indifferent, or it is malevolent. It is for us, against us, or doesn't care for us. So his idea was that, or not, I don't want to zero in on him, but the broad idea over there was that nature either doesn't care for us or nature is against us. And therefore, we have to learn to control nature. And if you see the scientific worldview, it also acknowledges that there are some realities far stronger than us. Scientific worldview, it basically replaces God with the laws of nature. Says the laws of nature are inviolable truths. Now, interestingly, when Prabhupada uses the word laws of nature, he uses it to refer to the laws of karma, broadly speaking. But when science uses the word laws of nature, it refers to the laws of physics, basically. Physics is considered the most fundamental of sciences, and from there, other branches of knowledge come up. So there, the idea is that if we just understand these laws, and then we tap into those laws, then we will gain power. And with that power, we will control nature. So the idea today has become that there is nothing divine. There are only these laws of nature. And these laws of nature are supreme. Now, Newton himself formulated or discovered. He discovered the laws of nature and he formulated them in mathematical terms. For example, the laws of gravity and the laws of motion. Now, he accepted that there was a higher organizing principle which brought about the laws of nature. So, see, if we human beings are existing, and say for him, an apple fell on his head. That is a legend. So, now, why did the apple fall on his head? He wanted an explanation for that. He accepted the idea that there is a God, and he saw when he discovered the law of gravity or the laws of motion, he said, "Oh Father, I think thy thoughts after thee." So he accepted that God is the ultimate cause, but he wanted to know the material mechanism by which the apple fell. And he came up with gravity, and he saw that God, it is you who have authored the law of gravity. So the idea is there is a mechanical explanation that for the apple falling. But beyond that, that mechanical explanation doesn't have to be the only explanation. There can be a still bigger explanation. And that is the divine explanation or the personal explanation. So things can be explained at multiple levels. Right now, when I am speaking, how am I able to speak? You could say it's because there's a functioning sound system. That's one explanation, perfectly valid explanation. We could go bigger and say there is a functioning power board, power supply system in the United Kingdoms, and that's why this is functioning. So the two explanations are not contradictory, they are complementary. That this sound system is functioning, and that's why I'm able to speak. And there's a functional electricity board, and that's why we are able to speak. So there can be multiple levels of explanations. That the rains are caused by clouds is not unknown to any thoughtful person. Now the rains are caused by the devatas, that is another ex level of explanation. So if you see in the Govardhan Leela or in the broad Vedic tradition, it is understood that rains come from clouds. But we don't close the explanatory frame at that level itself. You see, yes, this is one level of explanation, but there is another level also. So can the mechanical and we could say the divine or the personal go together? That is the Vedic understanding. Say, for example, there's a cricket match and say there's a final and the bowler bowls and you need 6 runs to win. And the batsman just hits a 6. And then after that, in the post-match interview, the interviewer asks, how did you hit the 6? And the batsman says, by Newton's laws of motion. Now, is that a valid explanation? Well, yeah, you could say the ball came at this speed, he moved the bat at this speed, the ball and the bat met at this angle, and that's why the ball was propelled over the fence. That's a okay explanation, but that's not the relevant explanation. When the interviewer is asking, he's asking, did you anticipate that he would bowl a bouncer and not a Yorker? How did you practice this hook shot? Have you practiced this before? So he wants a personal explanation. So the personal and the mechanical can both go together. But what happened in the modern context is, as we started, so originally the idea was that there was theism. Theism means God is the creator and the controller, both. Then we had what was called as deism, where God is the creator but not the controller. And there are laws, but the laws are what are controlling. Now God is not in charge. Like this clock, surely somebody made this clock, but that person who made the clock is not controlling it. If we just understand how the clock functions, we disassemble it, then we can change the time. We can change how it depicts. So the universe became more like a clock rather than a personal design. In our arguments for the existence of God, we say God is a designer and God is a lawmaker. But these two are completely different arguments. If we say God is the lawmaker, then God doesn't have to be the designer. If things are manufactured by law, that means say, if there is a manufacturing unit which operates by a particular algorithm, that okay, you mix this ingredient, put this pressure, and we get this particular circular keychain. So now, the mechanical law is making it, then there is no designer for it. You could say there's a designer for the law, but the designer is not designing the product. The law is designing the product. So what happened was, with time, the idea of the universe became deistic. That God is the creator, but he's not the controller. The controller is you, the laws of nature. And then after that, we came up with atheism. Where God is neither the creator nor the controller, both as done by the laws of nature. And so the modern view is largely, Prabhupada talks about economic development. The modern view is largely that if we just do sufficient economic development, then there'll be prosperity. And the idea is nature is providing us some resources, and nature's resources are limited. If we have too much population growth, then we'll have scarcity. Now, Malthus was a proponent of that. And there are many others who have bought into that theory. And you could say there is some truth to it. But the question is, there's a difference between some truth and soul truth. That the laws of nature and control, is that truth? Yes, there's some truth. So the material truth, like the mechanical explanation, the bat hit the ball at this angle, and that's why the ball went over the boundary. Is that true? Yeah, that's true. That's the material, or not just material, you can say mechanical truth. It's some truth. But some truth is not the sole truth. So the mistake which science, or especially those who have used science to propagate atheism, had done is, what is some truth, they have made it the sole truth. So yes, if we consider the earth is going to provide a certain amount of resources, and we have a certain number of living beings, then how are we going to survive if the number of living beings increase? But what we are not figuring in is that how much does the earth produce? What determines what the earth produces? So is it simply the mechanical laws of nature, or is something more going on? So in the contemporary context, the higher explanations have been neglected or rejected. And that is why the mainstream operational way of functioning is non-theistic. People may not be atheistic, but they are at least non-theistic. Okay, God is not a factor. So, how do we, this is the second part, so it's not useful to demonize people who say that, oh, you know, that if population increases, there will be a problem. Yeah, that is a valid conception if we have a particular frame of looking at things. So how do we link these two contexts? Is there a way to do that? That's the last part. I'll conclude with that. So the contemporary context where the laws of nature are considered to be supreme and we just tap into the laws of nature. And the traditional scriptural context where God is understood to be the supreme. So if we want to link or harmonize the two contexts, there are broadly, wherever we are, first is appreciate. You know, we need to appreciate that there is something higher beyond us that controls us. Now, that is not difficult to appreciate at all. Now, some people may say it's the government controlling me, it's the deep state controlling me, it is some dark people, some literati or whatever. People have different ideas of that something, somewhere, someone is controlling life and manipulating everyone like puppets. People have that idea. People may have different theories. Some theories are labeled as conspiracy theories. But we appreciate that there is some controllership. Now, can there be a hierarchy of controllership? There is a controllership, and is there a supreme controller? Ishwara Parama Krishna. So if we appreciate that there is some controller, might there be some higher controller above that? If somebody is saying that, say, you know, the government is evil and the government is controlling the world. This particular political party is evil. This particular group of people are terrible. Okay, they may be. So we are acknowledging that there is some controllership. So is there some controllership above it? So if we move upward the vision, sometimes, especially in today's world, we can become so conscious of specific forces that we deem evil that we can forget God. So, oh, people from this particular religion are evil. People from this particular region are terrible. People from this are terrible. So appreciate that there is some highest controller. There are levels of controllership, but there is a highest controller. And now, okay, it's a matter of choice for us. Is that highest control also evil? Is that higher control indifferent or good for us? So that's where only at the intellectual level we can't really realize. The next is connect. So if we are focused I'll make two quick points and conclude this session. Let's see, one of the fundamental problems in the Western philosophical tradition was that right from the birth of science, basically theorizing and practicing became separated. Religion was largely associated with Christianity, and Christianity itself became, for various reasons, largely a matter of believing rather than a matter of practicing to realize the beliefs. In the mainstream Christian practices nowadays, there is very little of what can be called as sadhana. Yes, you go to a church and you offer prayers, give some donations. But, okay, I acknowledge that God is there. But there are no practices designed for raising human consciousness. So it's like, say, I am existing over here. And say, this is the material domain in which I exist. So now, here, if I look, I can both see that there is some arrangement, there is some lack of arrangement. So I can look at what is the arrangement and appreciate it. But I can always see, oh, this thing went wrong in my life. Maybe God doesn't exist. So we need to have some tangible practices by which we appreciate that there may be some higher controller. But what is the nature of that controller? We cannot know that unless we have some practices to connect with that higher reality. And in the Western tradition, there are many philosophers, and many of them very intelligent, but they had no sadhana, no tangible practice to actually realize what they were talking about. So there has to be some kind of spiritual practice to connect with the reality. So the Gita sometimes tells, it offers us another worldview. There are so many worldviews are there. Gita also offers another worldview. Well, that is true. That is at the level of philosophy. But the Gita also gives us practice. It gives us yoga practice. It gives bhakti yoga. And that means it offers us another world to view. Not just another worldview, another way of looking at this world. But rather, the Gita connects us with a higher reality. There's another world to view. And when we connect with that higher reality, that is the time we start understanding that this reality is not only maintaining me in this world, but is actually my ultimate goal. Bahunam janmanamante jnanavan mam prapadyate vasudevah sarvamiti samatma sudurlabha. So we connect, and then ultimately that reality becomes our target. That I don't just want to connect so that reality will provide me things in this world. Rather, I want to connect with that reality because that reality is the ultimate goal of my life. So if we are going to look only at the material level, even as devotees, if we are going to primarily focus on material consciousness, then the evidence will always be ambivalent. Now one devotee may be terribly sick and they get cancer and they get miraculously cured and say, Krishna is so merciful. Another devotee gets cancer and they try so much and nothing happens and they die. So was Krishna not merciful at that time? Recently, when there was an assassination attempt on Trump, the Christian pastors, several of them said, oh, this was an act of God. Jesus saved him. There was some Indian devotee leader who said, once in a lifetime ago, he had served Jagannath. And that's why Jagannath protected him. Well, you can find evidence for God's action in this world, but others can always find evidence for God's non-action in this world. So, okay, both people you can ask, okay, so God protected this particular president, but in that crossfire, some innocent person was shot. Why didn't God protect that person? So is God partial to this person and not to that person? So now, can we see God's role in this world? Yes, we can. But my point is that there are always skeptics who can say, okay, God acted here, why didn't God act here? In the scriptures, Hanuman was victoriously successful. Jatayu was not. Jatayu was killed, brutally killed. So if we are only looking at the material level, then the evidence for Krishna's intervention and protection will be ambivalent. It won't be conclusive. It's only when we connect with Krishna and we make Krishna as our target, then we understand that Krishna provides for us, Krishna uplifts us, Krishna cares for us, even when the evidence of his caring for us at the material level is absent. So the way to actually, we will not be able to challenge atheism and defeat it at the material level of argumentation. Of course, we can challenge it and counter it and point out counter evidence. That based on the verdict of the world, we can establish a theism is also a reasonable and defensible belief system. But that it is the preferable, it is the beneficial way of looking at the world, that will come only through practice. That is, so when we connect with the Lord, so appreciate, connect and target. When we act, that is when we start realizing that actually Krishna is the maintainer. So in today's world, if we tell people, this many times, sometimes if we are not aware of the context, so some war happens And I've seen devotees on Quora or on social media saying that, oh, you know, because animals are being killed and babies are being aborted, that's why all these wars are happening. Now, devotees who make such statement get brutally trolled. Now, is there truth to that? Of course there is truth to that. But for people who are not able to see that worldview, all that they see is, they are seeing things from a particular framework. You know, okay, this country attacked over here, this country attacked over here, that's the cause. How do we resolve this? Now, we are talking from another worldview, a bigger framework. And for those who have not bought into that framework, who have not even understood that framework, our statements seem not only unreasonable, but they simply seem cruelly opportunistic. That means you are profiting from people's pain to stuff your ideology down our throat. That's what happens. And when we do it, we think it's reasonable. But in Nepal, when big earthquake had happened, there was an American pastor who said, this earthquake occurred, Nepal or North India, he said, because all these people over there are idol worshippers. And Jesus taught them a lesson so that they would all give up idol worship and they will become believers in the one true God. And actually, to some extent, it happened because Christians went and gave a lot of humanitarian support on the condition that you become Christians. So after the natural calamity, there was a huge conversion of people to Christianity. And what he saw? He saw that this was an act of God to inspire people to come towards God. Now, when somebody from some other religion does that, we feel it's an outrageous claim. But that's how people will see it when we make that claim. So, yes, is there a validity to the karma worldview, to the bhakti worldview? Of course it is there. But that worldview needs to be communicated appropriately. Without that, we will not only alienate, but even antagonize people. And if we say that anybody who doesn't accept this, that, you know, it's abortion and animal slaughter that is causing all this, that person is a demon. Well, not necessarily. Some of them could be demoniac, but many of them are just ignorant. They don't know this worldview and they're trying to make sense of life based on the worldview that they're operating. So it has to be very carefully done, connecting people who are operating within a particular worldview to the spiritual worldview. I'll summarize what I discussed today. We talked about broadly appreciating God's role in our lives. So I talked about it in three broad terms. First was the scriptural context. What is being said over here is that the universe, we depend on some unknown. And that unknown is favorable to us. Now, the unknown could be neutral. The unknown could also be unfavorable. But the Vedic understanding was, it is favorable. And we harmonize with that unknown. So we harmonize with that higher reality through giving offerings, through worship, through sacrifice. So the modern context was that, the contemporary context is that we only look at the mechanical explanation. We don't look at the personal explanation. So because of that, the idea is we just manipulate material nature, manipulation through technology, and everything will be provided for. That is what leads to provision. So how do we connect the two? It's by three things. V-A-C-T. First, we appreciate that there is some controller, and maybe there's a hierarchy of controllers. And maybe the highest controller is a benevolent controller. We connect with that higher controller through tangible practices that raise our vision from the material to the spiritual. And eventually, that spiritual reality becomes our target. It's only when that happens that we can see the benevolence of God. And that's how we can see how the Lord is connected with us. Now, appreciate is the first step. And we have to. There are two worldviews. Now, where the contemporary worldview and the scriptural worldview can intersect. And how we can communicate scriptural message to people. That has to be done very intelligently. How not to do it? I explained through the example of violence and wars in this world. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. ಗೌರ ಭಕ್ತ ವೃಂದ ಕೀ ಜಯ. ತಾಯಿ ಗೌರ ಪ್ರೇಮಾನಂದೇ.